Inflation increased from 3.1%, just a little bit up to 3.2%. Core inflation slightly improved from 3.9% to 3.8%. It's been what it was the last several quarters. We'll put a picture of the graph in the newsletter for those of you guys who are subscribed there. If you haven't yet, join our newsletter and check out all our stuff on our website, including we're unlocking a lot of our e-courses for you guys for free at thewealthelevator.com/club. Overall, this still remains above the Fed's target of 2%, emphasizing the ongoing inflationary pressures that is still out there. And what I feel like it's going to get off to the races maybe a year or two from now, which means why you need to stock up on hard assets such as real estate so you can be in the same position where we were back in 2020 to 2021 when prices were just going up with inflation. Now, on a brighter note, retail sales jumped a solid 5.5% compared to last year. And it seems like we're pretty sturdy in terms of the economy pushing through, even when jobs are a bit shakier. And I think everybody's feeling that we're in a bit of a recession right now. I do think that although the latest GDP numbers came out positive, we're going to start to see maybe in Q3 and Q4 a little bit of that dropping. It may not go negative, which is a official recession, but if it drops under that 1% threshold, I think that might signify the actual soft landing. But a lot of that is not leading indicators, but trailing indicators. And by the time we find that out later on this year, it's probably going to be too late to feel this bounce off the bottom. Where does that kind of put us at this point? Savvy investors, people that I hang out with, we're in this bit of a changing of the guard, suggesting a pause in rate cuts in May due to economic data. While the Fed's in this great position where they don't really need to do anything because nothing's really breaking yet. And at the first sign of maybe regional banks breaking, at that point, they can release the dry powder that they have and decrease the interest rates, which would be meaning well for a lot of real estate investments out there. Right now, if you look at CMG Financial and the Chatham Financial Curve, a lot of the professional data that we take a look at, we're seeing and predicting a June or July start to the decreases in interest rates. And if you've been following this podcast vlog for over the last year, at one time we were pretty certain that in May we were going to start to see these rate cuts, and this has been pushed back. That said, a lot of that is the macroeconomic environment. But really, when you're investing in individual projects, you really have to look at the individual deal and the situation that creates it, which is typically a seller who's in a distressed situation, or we're even taking a look at buying businesses and companies where you have the previous owner or the founder in a position where they would want to divest themselves of the investment. Now, switching gears a little bit to my own personal, you guys asked me like what's going on in our world with our company and like me and personally myself. Now, the 30% market correction over the last year has impacted my own personal finances. Despite this, my belief in investing in well underwritten projects capable of withstanding corrections still remains unshaken. From those new to investing, current conditions out there offer a unique opportunity to acquire these assets at significantly reduced prices. A shift from properties trading at four caps to now at six or higher represents a opening for discerning investors out there to capitalize on these valuations. Basically, the pros are out there swooping in at this point. To clarify, considering the market's transition, properties were once competitive are now available at more attractive yields, signaling this is the right time to get involved now. For those of you less familiar with these concepts, I recommend exploring our syndication e-course, which I just added another section in there last night. Particularly in section two, the numbers, when you take a look at any of these types of offerings, whether from us or another sponsor or syndicator out there. Now, the recent downturn, while challenging, also presents a less apparent national trend in commercial real estate, with some regions experiencing slightly lesser impacts. However, overall, like across the country, this has been a recalibration across the board. Now, reeling this back to more of a personal sense, beyond the numbers and everything out there, the tragic events in Hawaii underscores the paramount importance of mental health, especially within the context of financial stress. I'm going to leave the link in our newsletter for you guys to read on your own, as it's somewhat of a very triggering thing for a lot of us in Hawaii, and I think especially anywhere out there who has a family. Basically, somebody who committed suicide and took their family along due to financial troubles. Even before this, over the last several months, I've been working on a side project, and it was time to share some of the progress. I've initiated a podcast focusing on mindset and personal development and drawing from experiences that I believe resonate for many of you out there, especially first generation millionaires. A lot of us are very attuned to financial ambitions. If you guys are interested, reply back to this email newsletter, and we can send you a handful of the new episodes for this new podcast, which we're going to be calling the Rich Life Podcast, which essentially goes beyond a lot of the tactics, the numbers that we talk about on the Wealth Elevator podcast, but really hitting more of the human side of this. And your feedback out there on this new venture would be greatly appreciated, as this is the beginning stage of it. As I've self-reflected, going through these ups and now downs, it's not really about net worth, not really about money. It's more about the mindset and happiness and all the things that you hear about. But until you go through ups and downs, you don't really truly understand. And it's something I'm personally going through myself. And I always thought that was how the Simple Passive Wealth Elevator project all got started, was you guys following my journey. And I just wanted to also end this in closing that I encourage anyone facing challenges out there to seek support. Fostering a community of kindness and mutual support is very crucial more than ever. And then my commitment to being a service to all. So again, if you want to get some of those sample videos, reply back and the team can email that out to you. On today's podcast, we're going to be doing a replay of the office hours that we had this past month, which we hold every first Saturday in the morning. Again, if you are part of our email list, you guys will get access to that, and you can also jump on that live. So with that, enjoy the show. All right, so first question about infinite banking. The question was, how do you determine the or handle the documentation for accounting for your infinite banking loan? So I guess, yeah, this makes sense because I think a lot of people traditionally are getting their taxes bundled up. So here's how I do it. As far as writing off my infinite banking loans, I'm not going to play CPA or tax attorney here. If you guys need one, reach out. We can refer you to the folks that I use personally. But I tend to do things that at least I think are at least best practices and the checks the box, but is also least amount of brain damage in the process. So what I typically do is I'll request the statement from the carrier, whether that's PAN or Veritas or Guardian. There are different methods to doing this. Like some of them, I seem to get a better response by email. Some I call when it's like Guardian, I'll just email Tyler to do it for me. And to what I'm trying to get is that annual interest statement. So when you create your email, and for all you guys should be using ChatGPT to write all your emails. That's the key word to use. I'm looking for my annual interest statement because this statement is going to come directly from the carrier. And I think it's pretty much gold in terms of sticking that document in the file in case you are ever audited on this stuff. The second part, some people get really freaked out on the documentation. Like technically, you're supposed to use the money that you took from the infinite banking policy to make money. Whether typically what you guys are doing is, you may put $200,000 in your infinite banking policy and take that money right back out, drain out that cash value to go and invest in something. And the business that you're in is you're an investment firm in a way, with or without any type of LLC. LLCs are just for asset protection. I mentioned prior to, I've owned rental properties for years when I first started, even if I didn't have an LLC. Which some people said I was a bonehead for doing, but I always say I wasn't worth anything then. So there's really nothing to protect. So everything I use and I expense to in the pursuit of making money for that little investment firm was tax deductible, or I should write down on my ledger as an expense. So no difference here. Now you may want to go a step further. And this is just, I think it's a little optional and write a little memo saying, yeah, we took out this loan at the time of taking out the loan to go and invest it here. Some people will say you have to show the 50 grand that you took out of your infinite banking policy went exactly into this particular deal and maybe
going as far as having wire instructions to do it. And of course, you have your PPM to substantiate this. I think that's a little bit too much. And I think if you were ever to get audited, it's super practical, right? You're not just getting 50 grand and putting it into a deal. You may take 35 grand from your infinite banking policy. You may take 10,000 from your HELOC. You may take 3,500 from your liquidity and savings, right? It's going to come from a multiple of places. But, you know, it doesn't take much to pull this stuff together when you initiate the loans, or maybe if you do this at the end of the year. But, you know, having some type of paper trail to show this, what it does is, or at least the reason why I do it is you forget, right? And then you tend to do your taxes 1 or 2 years later. Your tax accountant asks you, and I think everybody should listening, you absolutely should not be using TurboTax or anything out there. A lot of you guys are big kids now, expect to pay more than $1,000 for your tax filings. But I think, you know, the whole idea is you make that 2 or 3-fold at least in terms of tax savings, which you need to get into alternative investments to get the tax benefits to then have the right CPA to get those tax savings for you. So what I used to have before I implemented QuickBooks, which I don't know why I didn't use QuickBooks sooner. And it's an amazing program. It's ran by Intuit, I believe, which is actually the same tax software. A lot of, I think they have TurboTax, but I think they also are the creator of a lot of these commercial tax softwares that a lot of the CPA pros will use too. So it all plays well together, this ecosystem that Intuit has acquired other companies to build. But prior to that, for years, I would just have a simple spreadsheet and I would have the categories of, I believe, the Schedule E on there. I can't name them off the top of my head, but like business interests, marketing, other expenses. Go look at the Schedule E. And I just had a spreadsheet where I had all the columns, and then I would just make a big list of all the expenses I would have. And in this case, we put a line item for 2023 interest expense specifically from your life insurance policy. The next question, do you pay capital gains on inherited property? Now, this is a loaded question, but we'll start off with the basics here. So generally, no, unless it's a $5 million or $20 million range, which the reason why I say that threshold is because depending on which state you're in and where the federal estate taxes laws go, these things tend to change over time, generally getting lower and lower, I think, in the future. But unless you're in that stratosphere, you don't really have to worry about estate taxes. But say you're 50 years old and your net worth is 1.5 million, you likely haven't been implementing these strategies that we talk about with alternative investments, the tax strategies, and the infinite accredited investor banking. More than likely, you'll retire or you'll pass away in your 70s or 80s with a net worth of 4 to 5 million. What I'm really talking about, like most people in our group, I would say are late 40s, early 50s, they may have a net worth of a couple million, and they're already starting to implement these strategies. I really have no doubt that a lot of people will have a net worth of well over 8 figures. And that's why I want to introduce this whole idea of estate taxes, because right now you think it's just a pie in the sky number. But with the mere fact of maybe you don't double your net worth every 5 to 6 years, but you are able to double a good portion of that every 5 to 6 years, you can quickly see how that net worth increases. Of course, that requires you to invest more than a couple $100,000, because that's not going to do anything. If you want to just invest a couple $100,000, go put it into venture capital where you can get 10, 20X on that, or an altcoin, but you could also lose it all there pretty quickly. And then with the fact that, like I said earlier, the estate taxes, these thresholds will probably come down. So it's just something to keep in mind. You may be like myself, like I'm like, my kids had more than a couple $1 million each. That's good enough for them. That any more will probably turn them like spoiled rotten. And I'm living more on the die with zero Bill Perkins method these days, at least for now. Of course, I'm pretty young and I'm sure I'll change my mind 3 or 4 times in the next even decade or two. But that's where my head's at. And some of you guys may be the same way, or you may just be like, look, yeah, I'll have $10 million by the time I pass away, but I'll be damned if like I pay a lot in taxes at that point, even though it makes logically no sense. And my heirs, my two or three generations below me, are completely taken care of. Of course, that's all we always tell people. You got to join a community like what we've created here, you know, the paid mastermind group, where you are able to plug your kids into so that they get around people who are not just getting a white collar professional job and just making a lot, spending a lot, and not understanding how to hone debt, leverage, and investing, and taxes too. But let me get back to the question. You pay capital gains on inherited property. Generally, no. When your parents, call this example, like your parents pass away, there's this cool rule called the step up basis. Essentially, the property's value is reset to what it's worth at the date of the original owner's death. This means if you inherit it and shortly thereafter sell it, you're only taxed on the gain above the new value. So I'll insert a cautionary tale here that one of my clients, he came to me and he said, yeah, my parents transferred ownership of the house before they passed away. At the time, logically, it was like, they know they're going to kick the bucket soon. So they just wanted to get this all settled before they went. But ooh, that was a big mistake, because that house had shot up from value from $50,000 way back in like the 90s. This was in California, a little apartment complex. And it was like a whopping $1 million+ over years. I think it was maybe a couple $1 million. So huge capital gain of over $2 million. Again, this is like a big whoops. Because they transferred it before death, he missed out on the step-up basis and he had to pay capital gains on the entire amount. So what he should have done is waited until they passed, then through a trust, or even going through dang probate, right? And paying like a percent or two on that would have been better than what they did. He would have got the step up basis and he would have reset his basis at that point. As a side note, now I think a lot of people have their primary residence, and we'll call it PR for short, which it really stands for principal residence. Notice how that's a little bit different than primary residence, because a primary residence suggests that it's your primary place of living. But your principal residence is a little bit different. And I would suggest, if this applies to you, maybe Googling that term a little bit more in detail. And of course, working with a lawyer on this. But there is a exemption for people's primary or principal residence, which I think a lot of us are very familiar with. But I'll go through it just for review here. Individuals can exclude up to $250,000 of capital gains on their principal residence. For couples, you can double that, so it's $500,000. So if the home has appreciated, selling it could be that tax-free way of harnessing some of those gains. And this is really one of the only ways you can outright extinguish a significant six-figure amount of taxes. A lot of the strategies out there are merely deferring, which if you defer things 5-10 years, that's a huge win in itself. Obviously, we try to defer things for longer than that. But this home sale exemption really is like the one thing out there that it's not a deferral. It's essentially a wipe out of taxes up until that $500,000 limit for couples. Why am I bringing this up? A lot of people tend to forget about this, and they might have bought their house at $500,000 a decade ago, and the dang thing has appreciated to well over $1 million or close to that. So they're reaching up to that $500,000 limit. Take notice, and maybe this is you out there. It may make sense to sell the property now and to move into a new place, whether bigger, smaller, same size, doesn't matter. But basically resetting your allotment for the next principal residence to get that next $500,000 gain. Because as soon as, like in an example, you bought the property for 500, now it's 1 million. Say you live in the house for a few more years and it goes out to 1.1 million. That $500,000 from the 500,000 to 1 million gets within that $500,000 allotment. But the delta $100,000, which you would have to pay capital gains tax on, is it worth not sheltering some of you guys like 40, 50 grand on that $100,000 right there? So I say that And I know what people are thinking, right? Oh, it's a pain and hassle. If I've been living in somewhere for more than 5, 10 years, then, you know, I got all my stuff here, right? It's a pain in the butt. My kids are in this school. Although that's never an excuse. If you can always rent and actually live in a better neighborhood to get them into a better school district. I think that point is negated with that. A lot of what we teach is very alternative thinking, but it makes sense if you really get down to it. This is definitely one of them too, where maybe it may make sense to rent and dump out all that equity in your house and also resetting your ceiling on your $500,000 principal residence exemption there. I would say for some of you guys who are above $2.5-3 million, probably you're probably like, yeah, I'm fine. You're good. I'm going to sit put, and whatever taxes I pay over my $500,000 allotment, it is what it is, but whatever, quality of life. And I say, cool, that's a great, right? You're already on your path to that $4-5 million end game level. I ain't talking to you guys. What I'm talking about are the people below that $1.5 million mark, because you got to get moving in a way, pull the goalie in some ways. You've got to either sell the property and move into a similar size property, or maybe even bigger, but dump out the equity to invest it. Some of the people on the lower end of the net worth range, yeah, you need to pull the goalie and do what I did, and actually in a way still do. I rent, and there's nothing to be ashamed of. It's not like you're not a responsible adult where you don't own your own house, but who really owns their own house, right? Like, I don't know. It depends on how the way you see life. The way I see it, you don't own nothing. We're just borrowing this timeline and life anyway. The bank really owns your house, really, right? When you have a mortgage, you can dump out all that equity and you could invest it to get to that $1.5-2 million plus range. And then you can breathe a sigh of relief a little bit and do things a little bit differently. But that's the whole concept of the wealth elevator. Is there's different floors and a sense of urgency for different people on the time horizon. But that was something, like, I guess personally, I was always like, I'm one of these people that delay gratifies forever. I've had the same lifestyle I've had for pretty much 5-10 years ago. It's nothing special. I probably spend a fraction of what you guys spend away. I've got a pretty simple life. Part of that is like renting and having a housing expense less than $4,000 a month. And that's living in Hawaii. And that's, I think, the secret to success or financial freedom, especially when you're under a few million dollars net worth, is cranking your expenses as low as you can, as low as that you can accept, or maybe what your spouse can accept. I had this idea of specifically for the house to live in. Yeah, at some point it would nice to be living in a nice house, but unfortunately here in Hawaii, because housing prices are so expensive out here, like anything under $2 million is whatever. It's like a stepping stone house in a way. So I had this idea of, all right, let me just delay gratify. Maybe I turn into my 40s and 50s and then buy a really killer house, be $4-5 million then. But then I started to think, and this is where, you know, you have an initial idea, but it's important not to hold on and grasp onto it. And this is where I started to realize, like I said, this $500,000 is this exemption is one of the only ways you not defer things, but extinguish that capital gain. And it's, in a way, it's dumb not to take advantage of it. So I took that to heart, and the way I changed my strategy was, I'm like, yeah, it'd be nice to just jump up to that really nice house. And when you do that, you expedite that there because you're able to take that equity and invest it as I have. But from a tax standpoint, using this principal resident exemption, it would make sense for me to buy a $1 million house. And then when it appreciates to 1.5, sell it, buy another house. And then when that, maybe that $1.4 million house goes up to 1.9, sell it. And then you use this kind of to stepstone my way. And then essentially not paying, going from $1 million house to a $5 million house, not paying any taxes. But you definitely go through a lot of brain damage in the process, a lot of paying the moving company 10 grand every single time, which that's, who cares, right? That's insignificant amount of money in terms of saving taxes on this, on each move. But yeah, spouse is probably going to be super pissed at me. But hey, that's saving money. And sometimes that's just a money problem never bought one of those Louis Vuitton purses or had to buy one of those expensive things for a bribe, but maybe I have to at that point. But hey, $500,000 at a savings rate of 40%, that's, if I save 200 grand, yeah, I'll buy a couple of $1,000 purse to move. Or some of you guys have a lot of girls investors too. Just, I guess the guys are cheaper. Just buy them like a Johnny Walker Blue or something like that. That's like a few hundred, couple hundred bucks if you're smart and you stock up on at Costco when they put that thing on sale. But that's marriage advice, which we're not getting into. Actually, we do have a little section of that in the Passive Investor e-course, which I think you guys should have access to. Brian, you want to come off mute? You had asked, but wouldn't keeping the home be more advantageous for the client? Legacy property taxes if he kept it as an investment property. I'm talking more about the place that they live, not necessarily investment property. But yeah, we can also go into investment property here. When you have an investment property, a place that you don't live in, a non-owner occupied property, this $250,000 exemption per spouse or $500,000 per couple does not apply there. Now, you get into some of these tricky quick cases where there's like a 2 out of 5 year rule where somebody may live in the house and then start to rent it out and then be alerted to that and be like, oh shoot, I got to go live back in it for X amount of months or years. That I would definitely talk to a CPA on that one, because for some people, it might make sense to like move back in. And I get it, because a lot of you guys are scrappy. You're like, let me just rent this thing out. I have two houses now. I had to move because of my company, or I got moved over to a different place, and let me make some money on this. But if that property has appreciated, you might have given all that money back up that you made during that time. And this is why sometimes it's smart to be, let the tax tail wag the dog, when most times letting that, having the tax tail wag the dog is not the way to do it.
If that happened to be a property that they knew they were going to keep, but not necessarily live in, like the complexity of, yeah, it might make sense to sell, let's say it's a $1 or $2 million property. Did the client still want to just keep it for like nostalgic reasons, not even to live in it? Then maybe that transfer could have made sense, because then annually those property taxes might still be much lower than if they had received the step up. And now it's at market value property taxes. And
so yeah, you're talking about kind of like California, right?
Yeah, like Prop 19. And yeah, it was just bringing up that hypothetical case. Maybe was that a potential consideration? They want to just keep it as an investment property, but then pay low annual property taxes like going forward.
Yeah, a good discussion, right? So for people not aware, in California, and I bet a lot of more of these like blue states have these types of things, where because prices have absolutely skyrocketed, like I guess in my base case, right? Like the family, they bought like a little apartment for 50 grand in the 80s or 90s. And it just absolutely like 20x'd from there, which typically happens in these like low cap primary markets like California, Prop 19. They have these kind of these tax breaks for the wealthy, because you always have to negotiate, right? Both sides, you got to do things out in the public that makes everybody happy because they're spreading the wealth around, but you got to give back some things where usually, let's just call it like grandma lives in the house right now. She's on fixed income. She lives in a $1.5 million estate in West Hollywood that she would have never been able to afford ever in her wildest dreams when she was working. But now she has the house and her property taxes would have skyrocketed maybe 10 times from what it was. So these laws are in place to keep it reasonable for them. And by transferring it over to the next person down the line, they get to inherit these sweet property taxes treatment. And this can go on to perpetuity. Now it's just like a simple math exercise, right? What are the property taxes for a house like that? And what would it be?
Yeah, I tried to look into some of the numbers. And so these are just hypothetical scenarios. Say maybe you bought the property back in 1990 or even a little bit earlier. Your annual tax could be in the realm of like maybe $5,000 to $6,000 today.
Like a $2 million property today, right? It sounds like.
Their annual taxes might be quadruple or even five times that, getting close to $25,000 to $30,000 annually. Good problem to have. I do believe like paying like a fair share of taxes does make sense, but it's just a very interesting problem people are facing.
Yeah. So here's the method I would go about doing it. Take the delta between the two. Let's just call it, just assume it goes up 5x, right? From 3,000 to 15,000. Does that sound fair? So a delta of $12,000. What I would do is just divide that by, call it a 3 cap. And I know this is residential real estate, but you can use the same commercial real estate formula to equate to how much money that costs. I guess you could do this every year and you could make a spreadsheet and like how much, what's the crossover point, but I'm just going $12,000 divided by 0.03. That might be $400,000 of value today, present value today. It's pie in the sky type of number, but the calculated set point or the neutral point, this is where you overlay like the wealth elevator type of method, which is like, who are you working with? And then who is the offspring? So if your offspring is like most people, uneducated about finances and likely to just take that $1 million, $2 million of profit from the sale and go blow it on Ferraris and stupid stuff because they just aren't uneducated and not connected with people, then it's probably better to keep the house, right? This is why everybody asks like, why IULs make sense. IULs are for people who are not adept at investing and for the mindless next generation to just keep it locked up in there and keep making a okay rate of return on it. But the whole question is, are you better than average? And most people who listen to a single financial podcast, you are already moving in that direction where you are, and you can, instead of driving the automatic transmission car, you have the ability to drive manual and get a lot better returns by selling the asset that way. That applies here in this case. But yeah, if I equate that to $400,000 at a 3 cap, then it seems like a lot of money. But what else could you have done with that money? If this family could have sold it and got $1 million or $2 million and invested that in something that got them 10%, that's 200 grand right there. I think that's a no-brainer.
That's a good point, Lane, in saying if they're worried that she will be pretty frivolous with the money, then yeah, of course, keep the property.
That's the simple analysis right there. Is this a type one average person, that the 99% of people out there, or are they the 1% of people who have their head on their shoulders and actually read a financial book like The Wealth Elevator or anyone, right? Heck, even take Dave Ramsey. No, never mind. They're better off leaving it in the dang house with no leverage and having appreciation than doing the Dave Ramsey thing. That's the simple analysis there. But if you wanted to get more nitty gritty, you do this calculation and then see what they could have done with the liquidity. What I'll give you another example. It sounds like that in your case, it's only one person, but typically there's three heirs, right? And they need to split $3 million. After that point, that dump out cash threshold per person has just gotten to a point where it's never going to change anybody's life. It's 400 grand per kid, and they've got their kids, and that's just going to get eaten up in like $50,000 chunks. Like, it's going to pay for this kid's college for a year. It's going to pay for this car. It's just going to get blown. But hey, maybe that's what it's money for, right? If you follow that die with zero method, maybe it's better to get broken up into multiple chunks like that. But this is falls into the whole idea of, if you're able to get your net worth over $4 to $5 million, it has a chance to keep going and grow with the next generation. But if you just have $1-2 million, that thing's just going to fall on its face by the time third generation comes around and make them even more spoiled at that point. But yeah, that's typically, there's multiple heirs in this type of situation. And I think the elephant in the room that most people will see in this case, not when it's your own, right? When it's your own scenario, you totally disregard this. But the whole nostalgia thing that you mentioned, we lived in there. This was our first house that we bought when we were 20s, and we kept it as a rental for 7 years. And we might want to move back into it one of these days, but Yeah, just calculate what you could be making on an annual basis. And then obviously that keeps growing. It's one of those hockey stick curves. Where would you be if you would have taken the money out and just invested at a base 10% and how that would compound on you? At some point, it's, yeah, I'd rather have a lifestyle where I get the $4 million than have a lifestyle where I peter out at $2 million and I have this house that I have an emotional connection to. It's all about decisions, right? And it's not a super hard calculation to do yourself, and that's where I leave people to their own devices. Hey, that's the decision. You want to get the $4 million and have this type of lifestyle? Or do you want to hold on to this house and have a sub $2 million net worth? Choice is yours. Life's about decisions and hard decisions.
It does seem like Proposition 19 is doing what it was intended and making people really question the value of keeping that property. The only, I guess you could call it, workaround is if the intention was to live in that property, I think they give you like about a year to move in. And if you are actually the heir, then you'd have to show that your parents were also living in that property. So they couldn't have just been using it as an investment property before you moved in. I think there's like $1 million in value that's excluded in that step up.
Nothing to say that they can't come back 5 years later and say, oh yeah, we changed our mind on this. You're going to start to jack your property taxes up to normal in the next 5 years. And therefore you're like, shoot, I should have just sold the dang thing 2020. And that's where you're at the whim of the government with something like that, which is, I think, why people tend to not like that stuff, because they have something to lose and they're squatting in their own house. They're stuck there. But if you look at other countries, Japan, the estate tax, the hit to semi-millionaires, which isn't much, I'm not saying it's like super high. It's not like the DECA $100 million people, but just mere people with $1 million. The estate taxes is super heavy, where the method in other countries, again, is like, I think they don't want legacy wealth to live in generations for very long. Where America, it's a lot less, maybe by a factor of two or three, less penalizing, or it allows money to stay in generations longer. Maybe it comes down to, in some of these other foreign countries, and I'm talking Japan specifically, because I think there you have an estate tax of half your money is gone when you pass away, just straight up gone. Where here it's not as heavy. It's, yeah, like I said, like a factor of two or three less penalizing than that. But overall, Prop 19 is just holding that barricade from overflooding in that way. But eventually, the way the laws are, they're moving towards the direction of what the foreign countries are doing, which is, it's just getting harder and harder. And it's the lower middle class getting worse and the richer. It's a separation of the rich and the poor, which we all know in other countries that this separation is way worse than America. And I've said it before, so when I started to invest, you could buy little rental properties for 90 grand that would rent for $1,000 a month. Now that same property is worth 140 and still rents for the same dang thing. It's this idea where just the affordability gap, we all know, but from a investor standpoint, it's getting harder and harder to create alpha unless you're in a kind of a bigger player. And that's how the foreign countries are too, right? Look at the rent to value ratios in some of these foreign countries, like a 1% rent to value ratio is just non-existent. Properties are like 0.5% or worse. They look very similar to that of Hawaii and California. And that's probably the trend where this is going to be going. But yeah, I never liked the idea of just having one asset held by a family, because you just create quarrel within the lower generations. I wrote a section about this in the book where the example was a beach house, right? The patriarch or the family, they value their generations, their kids, their grandkids to all get together in this beach house that they had. Maybe it's a few million dollars in Hawaii and all the kids can gather in it, because that was one of their family values, was that they spend time together. And it's a great idea. And I'm all for that if there's some other way that you could create the same sense of value. But the problem with that is you burden the next generation with this huge burden of managing this stupid asset, freaking beach house that keeps breaking. And then it also becomes an asset where people start to fight over. Yeah, you can get pretty nifty with the time sharing it amongst your dozen cousins and their kids. But at some point, it just be like, who's the manager? Who's going to be responsible for this thing? Unless you have some type of good management structure where, all right, there's one uncle who is in charge of this thing that cleans this thing up and pays all the bills. And he gets 10% of all the fake revenue that all the other cousins are using this asset. It just becomes a pain in the ass. Some point is just go and break this thing up and convert it to cash and just give it out to them and just say, you can only use this for spending time with each other. Go to the local hotel and have a staycation together to get the same effect. And then the other thing is that's great for families with $5, $10 million to have a $2 million beach house like that. But even in that one asset is a huge concentration of the family's wealth. And I've said it before, you don't want to have more than 5% of your net worth into any one type, one specific asset. Funds are a little bit different because they're diversified. As you can see, having a $2 million beach house and a $10 million estate, that is 20% of the estate right there. And that makes me feel uncomfortable, especially when you may have uneducated heirs managing this estate. All they got to do is mess up five times at 20% of the estate, and the estate's gone at that point. So this is where, when you get to that scale and you don't trust your, this is where IULs come into play, because you're not going to make a whole lot, but it's really hard to F that thing up. And that's the tool in the toolbox for that specific case. But if you're alive out there, you guys likely can do better than that type of product. Anyway, I think we beat that one to death. Good conversation. Sometimes it gets lonely on these office hours when you guys just type in your questions like that. Hey, Lane, you've been discussing over the last couple of months that with the way interest rates are, there could be a big buying opportunity in commercial real estate, and now is the time to jump in. Wondering if there are any plans this year to acquire distressed assets or even begin some new development deals. I like the idea of income fund, but I'm still relatively young and want to take some more risk and more reward. Yeah, so commercial real estate has come down 30% off the peaks of, I don't know exactly when that was, last year. And one could say that it's a great buying opportunity. But right now, if you're picking up those assets, you still have to contend with the bad capital market, which is like the loans. So in commercial real estate, the interest rates stay within a reasonable band. The way it manifests in commercial real estate lending is that the terms on the debt change. So we used to be able to get 70% loan to value on assets, but now that's down to 50%, meaning you have to bring a whole lot more to the table, which ultimately means the return on investment economics go way down, right? Because you have to bring a lot more to the table. So your principal is a lot more, which is why we haven't been buying anything since the summer of 2022, and which is why obviously everybody, 80 to 90% of other buyers aren't buying anything, which is why the prices have come down. So when do you reach a tipping point? And I would say the tipping point is probably about now, especially with interest rates looking to come back down here very shortly. If I put my finger on it again, I think it's that loan to values. When the loan to values start to come back on those commercial loan products, I think that's the trigger. The prices are great. If you see a deal out there saying that they got it 30% off of what it was, that's nothing really to get excited about. That's everything out there. Some of you can maybe even get 40%. Where the opportunity is now is like loan modification. There's a lot of good operators where they might have bought a property at $100 million and it's worth what's 30% off, $70 million, and the senior debt is $80 million. So they're underwater on the note, and no fault to the operator, right? They're kicking butt on their value add plan, but you know, when the value add plan on some of those properties are just to bump the net operating income or the value of the property by 10 to 20%, when you see a category 5 hurricane come and drop things 30%, you're underwater. This also puts the bank in the same position, because in a way, the bank, by assigning the loan and underwriting the deal initially, said, yeah, this is good. This is safe. This is a risk that we can accept. But now even the bank is screwed. So it creates this situation where, yeah, there might be a new buyer coming in, but unless they can get the right terms, they're not really looking to get involved in the project, which makes the old owner, the old operator, and the bank not reach a consensus. So there's an opportunity to what's called a loan modification. And I think I'll release a video next week on the YouTube channel specifically talking about this. But if you go back to the recent podcast with Troy Taylor, the restructuring consultant, we talked about it, I think, in the second half of the podcast, a loan modification. A very sophisticated party could come in to this type of 2-3-way negotiation. Exactly what it suggests, a loan modification from the bank, which might be a better term than going out and getting a fresh new loan from maybe even the same bank, because obviously everybody has skin in the game here. So they want to come through a consensus and they may have to give up chips in this negotiation. So that's a huge opportunity there. Obviously, a little investor buying their own rental properties aren't going to get access to these types of things. And no one talks about this type of stuff, obviously, but that's a huge opportunity to come in. And the second reason I really like it is, in a way, it's like you're picking a property up pre-foreclosure. Like once the property goes through foreclosure, the previous lender and the previous owner, they don't have any money. So the property is becoming dilapidated and the occupancy might have been 90%, probably will drop. Certainly things aren't getting fixed, like the light bulbs aren't getting fixed, et cetera. And you're getting a great deal, but you're picking up a property that had a lot of problems over the last 3 or 6 months. So it becomes a heavier lift, where if you're able to swoop in this pre-foreclosure type of stage with this loan modification, you're able to get a better note, but you're also able to go into a project where you already intimately know what the skeletons are and you're able to get it before things really go downhill from there. So that's what is the appeal to on that side. I get where you guys are saying it. And I would also say we have some older investors and younger investors where logically the younger investors be like, yeah, I need to grow my net worth because it's lower than the older guys and I have more time so I can be more aggressive. The older guys are thinking the opposite, but don't think with your entire portfolio. There's different portions of your portfolio that maybe you're the younger guy. You go 2/3 aggressive, 1/3 conservative, which I think is more the income fund. And play around with those types, the pie chart in a way, as opposed to just thinking about it in terms of give me all red or give me all conservative. And the real issue here is the younger investors, and I was there at one time myself too, you don't have very much money, or you can only invest $200,000 of your $1.5 million. And I want to remind everybody, the type of investing we do is not really asymmetric investing. It's not like you can like 5x, 10x your money and invest $100,000 and get $500,000 or $1 million. That's venture capital. That's altcoins in the crypto world. Now, if you guys are interested in this stuff, I'm looking at this stuff personally. I've joined the kind of the local angel group. I'm actually going to be going to a conference on Friday, I think, on this. But I'm actually looking at doing a little bit of this myself. Maybe it brings me back to where I was in 2015. Back then, we talked a lot about buying little turnkey rentals back then on this podcast. And very quietly, I was investing in syndication deals and private placements from 2015 to 2017. And call me a little bit of like gun shy, but I don't like to talk about things until I really do it. Starting to look at venture capital type of stuff, because with debt not being ready available, and who knows, if you look at the Chatham financial curves out 3 years, they're not predicting interest rates to ever go back to 2% or less. It's going to hover at 3%. Of course, there'll probably be some kind of black swan event, but more than likely inflation to go up and these prices to just skyrocket, which is typical real estate. That's where I'm like, real estate does really well when leverage is lower, and maybe the right place to look for alpha these days is buying businesses, which is private equity, which you need to have a certain amount of net worth to get access to those projects. Or venture capital, where you can turn $25,000 into $1 million. Obviously, you're going to lose money most of the time in those types of projects. But if an unemotional engineer went and made a spreadsheet of somebody's past performance in this type of world, you make it up on 1 out of 20 deals. That's something I'm looking at personally. And maybe, I don't know, if you guys shoot me an email of, yeah, like I'm looking for venture capital deals and maybe we segment you guys on a certain list. Yeah, let me know. Maybe head that way in the future. That also falls into what I talk about on the higher rungs of the wealth elevator. When you get above $3-4 million net worth, you have a $50,000 here, $100,000 here. That life's boring. And I think the reason why you guys get here is that you're going to continue to be investors. I've talked to a group recently of a lot of those guys were $10-20 million plus. They were also a lot older. And you would think that these guys would just want to do nothing and go cruise the world literally on a ship, but they are still engaged. They like to talk to me and they like to have these engaging conversations and invest. And what got them there was this is a hobby to them. It's fun. And in a way, you get a little desensitized to doubling your money in multifamily real estate and you're looking for a bigger hit, like drugs in a way. You look for these types of projects and you look for the right operator, and it's fun to you to pick the right horses and bet on the horses. And that's the way when you start to drift past $4-5 million net worth, being an angel investor in venture and capital, more asymmetric type of projects become more into the repertoire. Where I think it's a little bit, when you're starting out and your net worth is under $2 million, I think just start with the basics, right? That's why like initially the brand was simple passive cash flow. Like just go out and buy some rental properties and then the syndications, like focus on just building the base. Part of it is let's get you addicted to investing, right? I think it's a young man's mistake to just shoot for the moon initially, specifically calling out like, we have a subset of investors like this. Like, I don't want to offend you guys, but it's the guy who works in the tech field making $300,000 a year right out of college. And they think that because they're in the tech field, they're going to go make $25,000 venture capital investments. Sure, they know that they're probably going to lose money on most of them or all of them, but what's more likely to happen in that case for a new investor who's not connected is that they lose all their money just in bad projects, because that's just the nature of venture capital too. But I don't know, I think of it the opposite, is like just invest in more stable stuff. And the more net worth you have, that's when you get more risk tolerant. And that's when you go after more asymmetric type of plays, as opposed to the opposite, taking more risk up front or asymmetric plays up front. And then with the older you get, the more you decrease your risk tolerance. I guess now that I think about it, the traditional way of wealth building that Vanguard, all these companies say, is when you're younger, go after the growth stocks more, the higher risk stuff. And then as you get closer to retirement, that's when you titrate down. I guess what I'm saying and what I'm emulating myself is the complete opposite of that idea. The comment here was, angel investing is overrated, but investing as an LP in a venture capital fund makes sense. So you can invest in like little tech startups or even any brick and mortar startups. But what he's saying invest in a fund that might pool to go to a fund may invest in 10 different startups. And you get the instant diversification that way. Yeah, it's a valid point. I'm sure a lot of people could make the complete opposite point. If you know who you're working with, the operator is so much more important in venture capital and businesses than it is real estate. I think that's where, as long as you have an operator who's honest and somewhat competent in real estate, it'll be all right. And that's where it flip-flopped in angel investing. You can have a stupid idea, business plan, stupid idea. They're like, what? What's that? But if you have a proven operator who's more importantly connected, who can push a project to Wall Street and get it sold, get it IPO'd even, that's probably more important than what the actual idea was. But as an individual investor that you self-identify and the self-awareness of saying, hey, I'm all right. I'm a smart guy, but I don't know everything in venture capital. I don't know all the players. Then yeah, a fund makes sense. And that's where like from an investment point of view, if you're new to this, I think that's where the income fund makes sense because it's diversified into dozens of projects right off the bat, where I think most people make the mistake of they want to invest in this particular investment because they want to have the pride of ownership there. So again, same theme, right? That kind of gets people, whether it's their grandma's house or they want the pride of ownership of being in a syndication that buys 123 Main Street, 96 units in Arizona, whatever. What you want and what you go to initially isn't necessarily the best for you, especially in the early stages of learning this industry. But damn it, we all make the same mistakes. And that's what I'm here. And I had a recent call on this with several of my inner circle clients, and I made them very aware of this. If you guys want to do what you want to do, then by all means, do it. But my whole thing is at least know the other side and be somewhat aware of where you might have holes in your hypothesis. But yeah, the follow-up question, you asked a question like different investments or funds for different profiles. So I would say it's more, don't think of it as like income fund is only for the new guys or the older guys that are more conservative. Like, I think you need to do everything. You got to diversify over everything. And sure, maybe one profile may skew more towards income fund. Traditionally, the older folks who are looking more conservative, they'll be looking at the income fund for the diversification. The younger guys would not because they want to shoot for the moon. I actually think it's the complete opposite. The young guys should be going at being conservative and just, you got time on your side. You're already doing well. You're already on the tracks. Don't mess it up. The older guys, you got disposable income. So I'm just throwing that as a monkey wrench into people's thinking to shake you guys off of your probably traditional path of when you're younger, you take more risk. When you're older, you take less risk. I think a little bit of the complete opposite. But hopefully that just sets the sand more level so you can come at this and figure out what's best for you more from a neutral position. But what I do know is stocks are all-time highs and it hasn't gone through its recession yet. Look at ITR Economics. They have their sine curve and they got housing on the bottom right now and everything else hasn't gone through that dive yet. People say we're probably in a recession now, even though GDP is positive. I talk to business owners. Everybody's has 20-30% less orders. It's obvious. Sure, wages are still high, unemployment is still low, but if you talk to the business owners out there, that's not the case. And at some point, it's going to manifest its way out. But I do think we are heading to a very soft landing here, where 2025 and beyond look very promising, but it could all lead to a 2030 crash. All right, we'll finish up with this tax question on filing taxes jointly. Are there any tax considerations to keep in mind when deciding whether to invest in a syndication as an LP or one spouse's name or jointly? How about investing through a trust? So LLCs, these legal entities, in most cases have nothing to do with taxes. Of course, you need a CPA referral, let me know. Don't take my word for it. Now, when you start to get into like irrevocable trusts, which cost 30 grand plus, and really for the guys that are $4 million net worth and above, that might change a little some things. But as far as taxes, most of your guys' LLCs are disregarded entities, which means it passes to you personally and it all gets pooled with you personally. Like I might have 40 of my syndications that I signed through my LLC and 50 I did personally, maybe 10 is in my spouse's name. It doesn't matter. It all pools to the taxpayer at the end of the day. And that's where I collate it all there. But as far as taxes, it doesn't matter. Legally, a little bit different. But then now we're talking about being a passive investor, limited partner. That's essentially one of the big reasons why people go down this route for essentially zero legal liability. But I'm going to tell people, like most people, what I see, what you guys do is you guys just sign in your own personal name. It's your passive investor. What some people will do is, especially when they're higher net worth, is they don't get any like tax benefit from this, but eventually they're going to suck it into their irrevocable trust and get it out of their estate. getting it out of state is like when you really want to, you know, you get over eight figures and you really want to strategize what to have in your estate and not to get under that federal estate and state estate tax thresholds. That's the reason why you're doing that type of stuff. And to get out of your own personal name so you control everything, own nothing. But most of you guys don't have those irrevocable trusts. Most of you guys just have a will or a living trust, which the only thing that does is protects you against going through a annoying process called probate. So if you sign up through a trust name, then if you've died, then we got to look for the instructions on the trust and where to send the money. But most modern syndications these days, you guys have all your ACH information in there and it just blindly goes there with the push of the button. So there's really nothing to worry about there. I'll also say as a tag along to this, everybody here should probably have a trust. They usually cost maybe a couple grand. It's pretty simple to do. Most cases, I would suggest this is where it might make sense to have a good relationship with this attorney as opposed to just doing it, just getting the cheapest, the best person to do it. Because it's not you guys who are the educated ones that are switched on. When you die, you're not around anymore. You got to remember, it's the uneducated next generation. And a lot of times they need the old school, go into somebody's office and bedside manner and all that type of stuff. But the trust, the living trust, what that does is it says like this person owns all this stuff, these assets. And oh, by the way, in the appendix, which is really the only important part of the whole document, I would probably say it's important because it lists out all the stuff that you own. That page should be updated with all the things you've signed for, all the PPMs. Obviously, nobody does that. And it's one of those things like the best practice is to just go through there on a routine manner and just add it in there. Or if you die, you tell your buddy to throw your laptop into the ocean and you tell him to go update your appendix in your living document with all your syndications that you're in from your spreadsheet. You didn't hear that from me, and I'm not giving any legal advice, but I'm just telling you what I've heard from other people is one of the least brain damaged ways of doing this, because you're going to go through probate and it's going to come out either way, but that's one way of doing it. Putting your name on the trust. I just think that creates a lot of headaches. But anyway, it doesn't matter, right? From a tax standpoint. I guess that's getting back to the question.
Can I participate in a syndicated real estate deal, such as multifamily apartments, self-storage, mobile home parks, etc., a lot of different asset classes, without being accredited? I expect to be in a couple of years, but curious if I could partake now. All right. So we get this question a lot from investors, as today we primarily work with accredited investors, which if you go on the SEC website, basically you need to have an income above $200,000 a year if you're single, or $250,000 married filed jointly, or a net worth of over $1 million. And some people will look at that definition on the SEC website and where it's saying it's excluding your primary residence. In my opinion, a lot of people these days have a lot of debt equity, lazy equity in their house, which a few ways of getting that out is a HELOC, refinancing it. But for all intents and purposes, I would consider that into your net worth, at least to be like looking at syndicated deals. Today, been through the whole rental property thing. I had 11 rentals back in 2015. And my formula that we teach as an accredited investor or somebody getting on the path there, you are going to be dumping your rental properties because there's really no reason to have these things because it's just a pain. You don't get the great advantages of better deals, investing with professional operators. You're not doing value add in it unless you're doing that first strategy, which typically is done by lower net worth people who spend a lot of time and take a lot of risk in that endeavor. Most of our investors are high income earners and or high net worth people, and they have a higher hourly rate at something else, whether that's being a doctor, running their business. They are just not that real estate operator who is going to manage somebody to flip a house and doing that first strategy again. But going back to these kind of investors that are on the fringe, and look, I was there at one time. I started investing in 2009 with my first little rental property. Then it just took me a lot of years to just save up my money, paycheck after paycheck, diligently saving and being frugal to get up to 11 rentals in 2015. Even at that point, I was just on the cusp or just maybe a little bit over being an accredited investor at that point. at this time, I was able to use my network to find operators that did what's called 506B offerings. Now, what these offerings are, in contrast to the deals that we do today, which are 506C offerings, 506B offerings, they have some restrictions. But the things why it's important if you're a non-accredited investor is that you can get in if you have a personal relationship with the operator. Now, let's look at it from a different perspective. Now, 506C deals, this is where the operator is mass marketing the deal out there. And at this point, the government, SEC, is involved in all of these types of offerings. And at that point, once the deal kind of goes out on a podcast, a Facebook ad, or a billboard, the government has controls and protections. And in my opinion, they mean well, even though they may be a little misguided. And we'll talk about that later. If that deal is mass marketed, it automatically gets put in the category of a regulation 506C offering, which cannot accept non-accredited investors. And investors that are going into those deals need to have a third-party accreditation. It's not that hard. There are a bunch of third-party websites that verify this. You can just Google this on yourself. But a lot of things that our investors will do is get a letter from their CPA or their tax attorney, or just go about that way and getting that professional third-party sign-off. It's really the easiest way, and that's how I personally do it to get over this hump, as it is a requirement to getting into these deals. But again, going back to if you are a non-accredited investor, what you're looking for are these 506B offerings. And the key difference between the 506C offerings, these are not mass marketed to the general public. Let's take the crowdfunding websites out there, right? I'm not a huge fan of them. They typically have a different part of the capital stack that's not as good. Think of it as going to the butcher shop and the good meat goes out to the accredited investors, the real investors that are in the private network of the operator or syndicator. And then you got all the other scraps, which might be a lower return, might be lower on the capital stack, less secure. Anyway, it goes out to these crowdfunding websites and it gets, at that point, it's mass marketed. And this is why a lot of those deals, I truly believe that most of those deals are 506C because they are mass market and therefore they are accredited only deals. And I think there's a huge misnomer out there that, you know, investors feel like they just can't get into this stuff unless they are accredited, which is not the case. If you go on the SEC website, their database is called EDGAR, and you really want to go and geek out and go through their lists, huge lists of different deals out there, you'll see that most of those deals, the vast majority of them, are 506B offerings. The problem is, you as an accredited investor, most people do not have the network to be in the vicinity of people doing these deals. And therefore, they're not going to be able to have access to the 506B offerings that allow for a certain number of non-accredited investors. Now, when we started out with sort of the friends and family, the people that were around us, and we built really strong relationships with our early investors, and we did the 506B offerings. Later on, what we found is non-accredited investors typically are high maintenance. They have a lot of questions. And look, I'm all for educating people. And it's, I think the people that are anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million net worth, not quite there in terms of income, but these are the people where I was for the longest time. And I feel like these are the people that need this types of good deal flow the most. And this is my big qualms with how the regulations are made, right? They're made to protect against the one guy who doesn't have any money and just blindly invests on the internet or what he sees in some Facebook ad and then loses money, right? Case in point, all the FTX debacle, people don't understand what the heck they're investing in or investing in some altcoin. And you're seeing a lot of what used to happen in the regulated securities with syndication deals and IPOs, what happened back in the day, you're seeing that happen play out now in the crypto world. It's just the same thing over and over again. But what you're seeing there is unsophisticated investors are getting involved in these things, and the government wants to protect those people. So they're putting these regulations that you need to be accredited to get into these deals that are mass marketed. If you're a sophisticated investor, you need to go build your network. We've got that built out ecosystem within our group. You guys can join the club. All our deals are primarily for accredited investors these days, but that's really what our X factor is. Like, there is not another purely passive accredited investor group out there. And from interacting with other passive investors, colleagues, if you will. Like they say, your network is your net worth. And I'll just say from myself, when I started to do this and transition from little rental properties to big syndicated deals, I really didn't have any accredited investor buddies, family doing this stuff. I was doing it all my own and I had to get out of my shell, which is why we create these events and we have the ecosystem that we have today. Because I've always felt this is the hardest part, transitioning from the non-accredited investor basic rental property portfolio into the $1 million portfolio, the accredited investor portfolio, and then into the few million, $5 million net worth threshold and above, which I detail the exact steps to go through in my newest book. So if you're reading between the lines, you're a non-accredited investor, you make shy of $200,000, and your net worth isn't quite there yet, I'm not saying you should just shut it off and just go back to your rental properties, because that's a big world of pain, especially when you start to have evictions, you own these properties more than a few years. That stuff catches up with you. The whole idea of turnkey rentals are passive is completely not true. There is nothing turnkey about turnkey rentals or rental properties in general. So what I would say is keep your eyes and ears open and actively focus on building relationships with other purely passive, ideally accredited investors. And unfortunately, these guys aren't going to be at the local real estate club. Ideally, find those accredited investors and build relationships. And that's where you're going to go and find the deal flow. Sure, most of them may be 506B offerings, accredited only type of deals. But trust me, again, out there, most of the deals are 506B offerings. You can go verify it for yourself on the Edgar SEC website. You just have to find them. But more importantly, you have to find the people that will uncover those for you. If you guys are non-accredited investors, I'm sorry, it's tough for you. I was there at one time. But a lot of this has to do with just saving your money. And over time, your net worth will rise over $1 million. And this is why most of our investors these days are they're in their 40s. Because a big part of this whole wealth building equation is just time, right? Even if you're paying down your house, paying off your debt and your 401k and doing all the things we tell you not to do. A lot of people, they wake up to this stuff. They check out our channel and they check out the new book. And their net worth grows to be $1 million, $1.5 million. And part of that is just time. Of course, we're here to expedite that for you. And for some of you investors in your 20s and 30s, you guys are ahead of the curve. But still, you got to have patience. This is not the get rich quick scheme. This is the slow grind to using alternative assets to build your net worth slowly over time and then have it asymmetrically grow from there. If you guys are more interested in the accredited investor curriculum, join the clubs.
All right. With that, thanks everybody for coming. We'll see you guys next month.